Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by my independent bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop, Anne's Parnassus Books in Nashville. So our guest is Ann Patchett, who really needs no introduction, but since I always do it, I'll give one anyway. Ann has written 7 novels, including The Magician's Assistant, State of Wonder, and, of course, Bel Canto. She's been the recipient of the Orange Prize, the Penn Faulkner Award, has been New York Times Notable Books, and so many others. Ann's latest novel is The Dutch House, which will be released tomorrow. But if you want to be one of the first ones to get a signed copy and to hear part of the book and ask questions about it, you can hear all about it from Ann herself at the Free Library downtown tomorrow, Tuesday the 24th at 7:30. And if you miss that one, you can see her at Congregation Knesset Israel, where I was bar mitzvahed, and also ejected with my brother from Saturday services in front of 2,000 people. And you can see her there on Wednesday the 25th from 9:30 in the morning, I think until around 11:30 in the morning. So, The Dutch House, as in many of Ann's works, explores the intricacies and the emotional upheavals of a family. The story is set in Elkins Park, about 30 minutes from where we sit now, and is very nostalgic for me. I have many connections with that place and that time. But the book's real main character is a house, an extraordinary house with a history that suffuses, permeates the lives of everyone we meet. And with that, welcome, Ann, and thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm very happy to be here, and I'm sorry that I'm going to be the one to ask the first question. What did you and your brother do to get thrown out of synagogue?
Well, all my life I've been able to make anyone in my family laugh by simply looking at them.
Oh.
So after I got bar mitzvahed there and we were ready to get confirmed because it was a Reform temple, we were in the audience, which we had to go every Saturday in order to get credits to get confirmed. So I looked at Bob long enough for him to break out in maniacal laughter, then I did. And then Rabbi Korn, who wrote the book Jews and the Civil War.
I love that book. It's one of my favorites. I'm waiting for the Netflix series.
Yeah, well, he's not going to get any royalties because he died about 20 years ago.
I'm sorry.
So he stopped and he goes, in front of 2,000 people, Mr. Hankin and Mr. Hankin, please leave immediately.
Oh, my God.
Thank God my parents weren't there.
And that was on your bar mitzvah day?
It was after the bar mitzvah because you had to get both bar mitzvah and confirmed, which was good because you got money each time.
Well, that's good. All right.
Which we invested in the same savings and loan that's in your book.
Wild.
Well, you want to hear something? This is really wild. Give me 1 minute and then we'll get into the book. I grew up in Mount Airy. I moved to Jenkintown in Elkins Park in 1963, had my tonsils taken out at Abington Hospital. I went to Cheltenham, played against Bishop McDevitt, and I live just outside of Paoli now. And I hung out in Horsham as a kid next to the Naval Base by Willow Grove Park. So
Did you ever know any of the Buxbaum girls from Wincote on Washington Lane?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was right up the street. It was one street over from Greenwood Avenue. Yeah, I remember.
Erica, Tamar, and Karen. Erica's my age, 55. Tamar, probably 53. And then Karen, I think, is 50.
Yeah, I'm 67, so my brother is in his mid-50s. He's the one who would have known them, but I remember their names.
Well, so Erica and I were in the same dorm as freshmen at Sarah Lawrence, and I used to go home with her on the weekends.
Oh.
And they had a big grand house on Washington Lane, and I loved her family. I loved her parents, and they were incredibly good to me, and I was close to them my whole life. And so, that's how I got to that area.
Is their house the Dutch house?
Their house isn't the Dutch house, but their house was a big, happy, magical, informal, giant but informal house that I deeply loved.
So
I also knew that if I set the house in Elkins Park, I could call Erica and her sisters and say, wait, now, where would he go to high school? Where would he go to the hospital? And so that's how I got all my information.
That's incredible because, you know, I looked at your Wikipedia stuff and all that, and I'm thinking, she didn't grow up there. How would she even know about that stuff?
You know, it's really helpful when I write a novel. I live in Nashville. I could never write a novel set in Nashville. I like to write about places that I know a little bit, but not incredibly well, because I feel like then I have freedom of imagination. If I know a place inside and out, I feel too constricted and worried about getting things right or wrong.
Yeah, one of the reasons I can't really write a novel is because I always forget that a writer can lie. I feel it's like a stand-up comedian giving the same act every night. It just bothers me. totally off the wall, I assume you read Parnassus on Wheels and The Haunted Bookshop by Christopher Morley, I assume.
Yes, and in fact, my business partner is a woman named Karen Hayes. We were introduced to each other as the two women in town who both were interested in opening a bookstore, and the reason she wanted to name the store Parnassus was because of Christopher Morley and because her big dream was to have a bookmobile, and we have a bookmobile now.
Parnassus on Wheels.
Parnassus on Wheels.
That's amazing. It's so funny that I found those books in McManus Books in Wayne, and they were there because McManus's grandfather put them there, and they were there for 50 years. No one else is going to buy them except me. but, yeah, I love both of those books. So in any event, beginning, the protagonist is the house, and so we're here to, you know, help you have people come to both of these events and also to, you know, start the book off. So, you know, tell me how you decided that that would be the case, that, and you can get to the characters as well, but so we get started. Tell me how you decided that the house was going to be the central gnomon pivotal point of this book.
You know, it's funny because these things evolve very slowly over time. And I spend a long time working up a story in my head. And originally, the book was going to be called Maeve. And then later on, I thought, I'm going to call the book Maeve or the Dutch House, one long title, like a Graham Greene novel. And then finally I thought, oh no, I should just call it the Dutch House. But it would be interesting to know if you would still feel that way if the book was called Maeve instead of the Dutch House. You know, who becomes the main character, what becomes the main character is set out by the title. But I wasn't sitting there thinking, oh, I'm going to write a book that really is about the house. To me, it was a book very much about the brother and sister. But the house represented the past and how we hang on to our past and how we hang on to our old hurts. And also, at the time, I was really wrestling with the idea of wealth and poverty, which is a through line through all of my books. But the idea that that being really rich isn't necessarily the greatest joy for everyone in the world. It isn't what we all long for. And sometimes in our country right now, I feel that there is such a celebration of individual wealth that I wanted to look at that and say, okay, well, you know, having the very biggest, best house isn't always the very best thing that could happen. And actually, a person could choose to reject that kind of wealth.
And Danny's father, you know, tells Danny, it's you're better off being poor than having a bunch of money, which I agree with 100%.
Yeah, I do too. But, you know, people will say to me sometimes, why don't you write more political books? And I think, well, this is political. I mean, it's a family story, but it comes very much out of my feelings for these times that we're living in.
And granted, when you probably started this book, you were kind of prescient because, you know, not to get into it, but look what is happening today.
Yeah, exactly.
See, if the book was called Maeve, Maeve is obviously my heroine, not only because of her actions, but because of her sense of humor. But I think you get a much broader audience by calling it the Dutch House, just because men are idiots. But
there you go. And because I own a bookstore, I know that.
Right. And the cover, too. The cover is great. And as many times as people come into my bookstore and people tell me you can't judge a book by its cover, every single person who comes in judges the book by its cover.
You are so right. Can I tell you about the cover?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I wanted you to.
I love this cover. So it was very, and let me just say, for the people who have not seen the book, it is a painting of Maeve. And in the book, there is a painting of Maeve that's pivotal to the whole story. Very formal portrait of her when she's 10. And when I finished the book, I thought, I know I never want a house on the cover of this book. I don't want any part of a house, not a window, not a portico, not a door, because the house has to live in the imagination of the reader. But I wanted this particular portrait that's in the book on the cover. And I called a friend of mine in Nashville, a painter named Noah Satterstrom, whose work I love. And I said, okay, Noah, what I need is a portrait of a 10-year-old girl with black hair in a red coat. It would have been painted in 1950 in the style of 1910, and the painter was Scottish. Can you do that? And he said, yeah, no, not a problem. And he painted that in 4 days without having read the book, and that's it.
Wow.
It's hanging in my living room, and it's the cover of the novel.
Wow, Simon took 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's really incredible. But what I love is the cover is part of the story. So you're reading the book, and at some point you think, oh, my gosh, that's the painting that's in the Dutch house.
And he got her hair perfectly because you describe her hair on so many different occasions. And, yeah, it is amazing. And I think, again, if it just said Maeve on the cover, as you know, as a bookseller, then you'd be limiting, and this is chauvinistic, but you'd be limiting your audience to mostly women, I think. Don't you think?
Yeah,
I know.
It's true.
So
something crazy like 80% of all fiction is purchased by women.
I know. It's like
I own this store, and the fiction is on the left-hand side when you come in, and the nonfiction is on the right-hand side. And all day long, you can watch people come in, and the women go to the left, and the men go to the right.
Yeah, it's like your book clubs, my book clubs. They're all women. Except for my nonfiction book club where guys come in. That's it. I've never seen guys in any of the other book clubs ever, not once.
It's true, and if you ask men, often what they'll say, and of course you're going to get tons of emails and phone calls saying, I'm a man and I read plenty of fiction. But so many men will say, you know, if I read a book, I want to learn something. So I'm going to read nonfiction. I don't want to waste my time with stories. I want to learn something. And I think there's probably plenty to learn in a novel.
Yeah, I mean, just by reading tiny books like The Stranger or Old Mad in the Sea or Crime and Punishment, you learn more than you would learn from most nonfiction books.
I agree with you. Moby Dick?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I interviewed a guy who wrote a book called Why Read Moby Dick.
Oh, I remember that book.
And
that was great.
And he was really obsessed with it. And he said, anything you ever want to know, you can find in Moby Dick. And I said, what about, like, you know, Trump coming along? And he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, that's in there. I said, so he thought of it as Nostradamus.
I get that. I mean, I think that if you could say to humanity, okay, you just get one novel, a very good case could be made for that novel being Moby Dick.
Well, let's get back to selling your book.
Okay, please.
So we have Danny, who's the narrator. Danny is not as much my hero as, certainly not as much as Maeve is, but would you say, without giving anything away, would you say that Danny is a reliable narrator?
Yeah. I think that Danny probably is a reliable narrator. I think that Danny, a reliable narrator in my mind, is someone who isn't lying. And I think that Danny is not lying or stretching the truth. The problem with Danny is that he doesn't realize the extent to which the service of all the women who surround him holds up his life. And that's true of many men that I know. He's a lovely, charming, smart, affable guy, who is served by women at every turn, and he doesn't recognize that.
But his self-reflection, I don't want to say it's solipsistic, but his self-reflection is always there, and he's always not sure, or in the case of his father and Celeste, he's not sure whether what he's doing is one right, or whether, or questioning what is the meaning of what he did, you know?
Yeah.
Which is kind of odd in a way. I mean, well, no, it isn't. That's exactly the way I am. Never mind.
Yeah, I think that is the way people are.
Which goes to, like, you know, Julian Barnes in The Sense of an Ending. I mean, what, and you bring it up in the book, too. Maeve and Danny are sitting in the car outside the house, and they're wondering. Danny says, is what we remember, the way it really happened.
And don't you ask yourself that question?
Of course.
All the time. It's funny, this morning I was talking to my childhood best friend, woman I've been friends with since we were six, and I had found a picture of her, and she had written a note, this is when we were in high school, on the back of it, and I found it the other day, and I took a picture of the note, and I sent it to her. It was so crazy. It didn't sound like anything she would have ever said. And she called me. She said, is this a joke? Did you forge this? And I said, no, it was on the back of your photograph. This was the note you wrote to me. We would never have remembered that. We would never have believed it was true if someone had told us that. But it was. There it was. So I think that that is a very interesting exercise. People are so sure of their own memories of their past, but then you can get all sorts of evidence. We're wrong. We're wrong.
Yeah, and it's a kind of a cliche, but, you know, every time you remember the memory, you kind of change it slightly. And
that's right. And you grow farther and farther away from the event itself.
Yeah.
Malcolm Gladwell did a great podcast about that.
Oh, I will have to find that. And that, again, that goes to Sense of an Ending because it's essentially an epistolary disaster. But anyway, so again, back to the book.
Yes.
So if you say that Andrea is a bad person, and I don't know whether she's a bad person or not, but everybody else in the book is good. Maeve is good. Her boss is good. Sandy, Jocelyn, Fluffy, Norma, Bright, Celeste too, really, and their daughter, May, and Cyril. Kind of, pretty much. So do you like writing books in which pretty much everybody is good?
I was talking to somebody about this last night. You know, if I had written a book about serial killers and you were interviewing me, you wouldn't say, do you like writing books in which people are bad? Because somehow we are wired to believe in bad more than we are wired to believe in good. And yet, for most of us, and certainly is this true for me, my life, I am surrounded by good people. I am surrounded by kind, helpful, good people. And yet there's something suspicious about writing about people who are like the people that we know in our lives. You think about the people that you're close to, the people who you deal with every day. Wouldn't you say most of them are good people?
I wouldn't be with them if they weren't, I guess.
There you go. Right. So even though I don't know any murderers, if I was writing about murderers, people would say, well, that's true. That's real. And yet if you write about a bunch of good people, people say, well, that, you know, that's Pollyanna-ish. That's rose-colored glasses. I actually don't think so. I think that it's closer to the way most of us live our lives.
I think that's true, especially when a book is plot-driven, and this one is. And
right, plenty of things happen. It's not like they're all just sitting at a picnic all day.
Yeah, that's definitely true. But you're right. I mean, you think of TV. Pretty much every show is about bad people, or at least a lot of bad people.
Right.
Yeah, otherwise people wouldn't watch it.
Yeah, and so we think that that's the world, even though if we open our eyes to our own life, it's pretty good.
And like Cyril, for example, a complicated man who projects love and not the absence of love, but practicality or whatever you want to call it, it reminds me of my dad, because my dad called me a jackass all my life. And it took me 20 years of therapy to realize what he was saying was, I love you.
Oh, that's great. I'm so glad you did the work to figure that out.
Yeah, I know. It's the last thing he said. He died on April 15th after signing his taxes. And the last thing he said to me on Wednesday was, if you weren't such a jackass, this would never have happened. His last words to me.
Wow.
Oh. So here's something.
I completely believe that. And what Cyril is he's what we would say now emotionally unavailable. But that's the way they used to make fathers. They were emotionally unavailable. It didn't mean that they didn't love us. It didn't mean that they weren't good men. But they weren't the fathers that we would say, these are the fathers we want today.
We lived in a house that my father built in Tarancoid here in Chester County. And this guy who lived nearby bought our house without telling his wife. She was a little
interesting.
She was a little off, so this gets more interesting. So when they moved in, 2 weeks after they moved in, she hung herself in the garage.
Wow.
So, and that resonated with me exactly. Well, not somehow. The other thing is, again, off the walls, cigarettes are very important in this book. Why?
Wait, say that again?
Cigarettes and smoking are really...
Oh, do you know what I thought you said?
What?
I thought you said bigamists are very important in this book.
Well,
if what?
The closest you can get is fluffy, I guess.
Cigarettes.
Yes, they're very important. I mean, that's how the Dutch House became the Dutch House, and that's what Maeve and Danny do out there.
Yeah.
Why?
And you could say was very tied to, yeah, other things that happen in the book. Why?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. You know, people smoke. It, okay, if I'm going to break it down, because cigarettes used to be great. Cigarettes were given out in the wars, World War One and World War Two, as morale boosters. They were like the gift that the soldiers received. And tons of money was made off of cigarettes. And they were considered to be glamorous and a reward and just a beautiful thing, nothing better than a cigarette. And so this enormous house is built on the money that was made from cigarettes. And yet over time, what we as a society have discovered is that cigarettes are in fact not good for you. And they're not a good thing, and they're not glamorous, and they're not elegant. And then our view of the cigarettes changed. So, yes, cigarettes run parallel to the Dutch House.
Yeah, all through, including the, well, never mind.
And also, I used to smoke, and I miss it.
Me too.
Yeah.
I smoked Lucky's.
Oh, Winston's.
And then Marlboro's.
I used to say that my first novel was the first novel to have been written entirely on Winston's and Good and Plenty's.
Ooh, more autobiographical of me again. yeah, my Uncle Raymond designed the box for Good and Plenty and for Raisinets and Goobers.
My gosh, and those designs have never changed.
I know. He was a commercial artist.
Because they were so completely right on.
I know, and we would go down to his studio and mess everything up, and he would almost kill us.
Wow.
Play with his pens and
well,
stuff.
Well, the next time I get a box of Good and Plenty's, a rare treat in my life now.
I know.
But I will think of your Uncle Raymond.
The one thing that bothered me about the cigarettes in the book, but then now that you've explained it, I understand, is how they pitch them. And I remember, don't you remember how you pinched them? You took your thumb and your forefinger and just kind of pinched it?
Yeah.
And I was thinking, that's littering.
Oh well, yeah, but there's one part where Maeve yells at Danny for throwing the cigarette out the window, but then there's another part where they are particularly enraged and smoking and throwing them out the window as fast they can because they are mad at the land on which they are throwing their cigarette butts.
Yeah, they have an incredible emotional attachment to the house, but the undercurrent is a certain fear of the house that, again, without spoilers, is like gone away by one action of... We'll talk a little bit about Maeve and Danny's mother and who she is.
So her name is Elna, and she and Cyril grew up. They were neighbors in Brooklyn. They were both really poor from big Irish Catholic families. And Elna, I don't want to say she loved her poverty, but those were her people. Those were her neighbors and her friends and her family. They were poor people. And they went to Mass, and she worked for the poor. She worked in the soup kitchen. She worked for the clothing drive. It was about being poor and helping the poor. And when she is taken out of that world by her husband, who surprises her by his sudden onset tremendous wealth in which he buys this house. And of course, this is at the end of World War II, when there really was not an American middle class. People were either poor or they were rich. And so the jump from one thing to another is almost more than we can imagine. And the jump that her husband asks her to make is just too much, and she runs away from home. And I will leave it at that.
Well, without, again, giving anything away, do you think that it's true that saints who help the world are generally their families have a big problem with that?
Like, yeah, there's a line at the end of the book that says something like, saints are probably universally despised by their families.
Yeah, like...
I think that is probably true. There was a play last year about Joan of Arc's mother. And, you know, what a really bad job that would have been, right? To be Joan of Arc's mother?
Yeah, or... Siddhartha's parents, or Einstein's wife, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. They did.
I mean, I think all of those stories are tragic and completely forgotten. While someone goes ahead and does great things, the people that person leaves in his or her wake are usually pretty destroyed.
I'm going to have to research now who the parents of Mother Teresa were.
Oh, that's an interesting question. Did you ever read Colum Tobin's book, The Testament of Mary?
No.
Such a good book, and oh my gosh, Meryl Streep does the audio. It's very short, and it's Meryl Streep's greatest performance. And it's really about what a tremendous drag it was to be the mother of Christ.
Yeah.
And certainly that was a book that influenced the Dutch House and got me thinking, yeah, what would it be like if your mother turned out to be a saint?
Oh, that
good.
That reminds me of a joke about they find this thing in the Dead Sea, and it's a scroll of an interview with Mary, and they say, aren't you proud of your son? And isn't it amazing that your son is the Son of God and the Messiah, and he's wonderful? And she goes, yes, I'm proud of him, but I was hoping for a girl. it's like, this is, again, I just do this, I'm sorry. But it really is hard to repair drywall, because I was just doing it. Did you try to do it, or did you have them? How do you know that?
I know it two ways. One, my sister is a genius, and she's somebody who can hang drywall, she can rewire your house, she can fix the plumbing, she can make a chest of drawers. I mean, she's just one of those people. So I know it from her. Also, I have a friend who lives three doors down from me, Cyril, whose name is Cyril, who's an architect. And he was incredibly helpful. I was forever bringing chapters down to Cyril and say, okay, give me a detail of this, give me a detail of that. And I think that Cyril was the one who said, you know, drywall's a lot trickier than you think.
I know. There's so many reasons why it is, especially taping it afterwards and getting up on those stilts, and there's just so many things. But it's really good to have a sister like that. Wow.
It's so good. You know, when my faucet breaks, she will go to Home Depot, buy me a new faucet, and install it.
I have a friend who can do all that AC, drywall, plumbing, electrical, and he's really sick now. So whenever I go over to his house, I say, look, you can't die because I need you to do all this stuff.
That's right.
And I think that's a help to him.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody needs to be needed.
So going back to Andrea, do you think she's a bad person?
Yeah, I do.
Ooh, really?
Yeah. So here's my thing. If you were to read all of my books, which I don't think you should, there is a remarkable absence of villains. I just really don't write good villains. And I mean, the villains, the people who I think are going to be villains always turn out to be nice guys. So I was really digging in with Andrea. I was really trying to explore her villainy. Now, of course, we could say, no doubt she's insecure and she's afraid and, you know, she's a limited person or whatever. But yeah, she does some bad things.
Yeah, she's kind of a archetype. From
yes,
even
there are a lot of little fairy tale motifs.
Yeah, Cinderella
going
being the
through
first
the
one.
Book.
Yeah,
there's one point at which Danny's wife Celeste says, you know, what are you guys, Hansel and Gretel? You're never going to grow up. You're always going to be walking through the woods holding hands. And I think that's quite true. And it was the stepmother who sent Hansel and Gretel out into the woods.
You know, at first I thought Celeste was going to tip that way. And she was so sweet, lovely in that first scene. That was such a beautifully drawn first scene on the train.
Yeah.
And then with her relationship with Maeve, I thought she was going to tip into something different. But then when Maeve had that incident, Celeste was right there for her.
Yeah.
And that made me think, okay, none of this is her fault. She's just reacting.
Well, and Celeste is also the voice of reason.
Yeah.
So many instances, Celeste is right, and nobody wants to hear it, because we love Danny and Maeve, and we love their relationship, and Celeste is kind of hopping up and down saying, this is insane. And you think, oh, Celeste, you're so irritating. But then as the book goes along, you're like, oh, Celeste, you're on to something here.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, one of my book clubs I call Fight Club, because you expect the people to be reaching across the table, grabbing each other. And that, and when you have your book club about this book, there'll be people that have completely different ideas, I think, which I think that's great in a book, don't you? About the
yeah,
camp.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I always say literary fiction is like love. You know, it's two people meet. One person is the book, and one person is the reader. And sometimes there's going to be chemistry, and the person's going to love the book. And other times there's going to be a different kind of chemistry, and the person's going to hate the book. And that's why you can get a fantastic review and a horrible review the next day. Sometimes from one paper. I mean, I've had it happen in the New York Times that I'll get a terrible review on Sunday and then a glowing review on Monday.
I've seen it. And you talk about not reading your books. Well, I have. But if you go back, and two things. If you go back to Bel Canto, you have, well, I can say it, you have this terrorist organization and these victims. But the terrorists kind of aren't really bad people.
No, they're kind of a lovable bunch of goofballs.
Yeah, exactly. So even that, you know, you expect it at the outset to be, you know, exactly what we were talking about, this gruesome, violent kind of thing, and then it's not.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting because that book came out in May of 2001.
Wow.
And I often think that's probably not a book I could write now.
No.
I don't think you could write a book about, you know, kid terrorist who are goofballs. That world's gone.
And I wonder what that means. It's almost like, how do we come to this point where you can't release something that's about this because of the World Trade Center, for example, or because of El Paso?
Yeah.
I don't know what that really means.
The world changes. You know, you couldn't publish
no.
McFinn either, so the world changes.
No, you're right, 100%. Let's see. This is one I always ask that doesn't go to spoiling any book, is when you write a book like Bel Canto or like this one, at the end, a lot of people, and I've said this about my brother so many times and he gets upset with me, he likes books to end where they're wrapped up in a box, then wrapped in paper, then tied with a ribbon.
Mm-hmm.
And this book is not like that, really. So that's a question I have about whether you would like books that kind of let the reader at the end kind of just decide. I wonder what happens now. I wonder what he's going to do. Or do you like to just say, you know, do what I said, wrap it up and be done with it?
Well, I think, again, that's a difference between commercial fiction and literary fiction.
Correct.
And I have loads of respect for commercial fiction. But commercial fiction puts you in the back of the Lincoln Town Car and drives you there, right? You know, it just takes care of you, entertains you, and that's wonderful. There is absolutely a time for that. But I think that literary fiction turns you out into the world. And so what I want to do is say, I am giving you a lot of information about these people, and at the end of the book, I'm done with them. But I want you to go forward with them. I want you to keep thinking about them, to imagine their lives, to imagine what happens to them after a point when I'm out of the story. I want the story to become your story. So if it's all wrapped up, if it's finished, that means you think backwards instead of forwards. I'm interested in having people think forwards. Just for me, you know, not that I think that's the right way, but that's what I like to do in my books.
Yeah, and that reminds me about, well, two things at my bookstore. A 12-year-old boy came in and wanted to buy War and Peace. And he's 12 years old and he wants to buy War and Peace, so there's no way I can make him pay for that. So I just gave him the book and I gave him another book. You can't charge a 12-year-old for that, you know. And then the other thing is, I saw the Stephen Colbert interview. The thing about Amazon is you buy a book, that's it. And they give you recommendations, but they're silly.
Well, and they're also purchased.
Oh, that's true. I never really thought about that, but you're right.
Yeah, they are, you know, the publisher has paid Amazon to say, if you liked The Dutch House, buy this book. Yeah.
Yeah, and so the thing about my bookstore, which looks like Diagon Alley, which I like. I have book ladders, and which I've always wanted all my life. And so when someone comes in, whoever it is, and they're looking for a particular book, especially in the stacks and the used books, they find the book they want, but they also see the book on the left and the book on the right. And
yeah,
one of those books might change their life, and they wouldn't see it otherwise.
My gosh. I mean, I own a bookstore. This happens to me every time I walk in, that I see a book on the end shelf, you know, something that one of the people at the store has put on display, and I'm like, oh, look at that. Look at that book of puppies swimming. I want to look at that. Look at that book about relativity. I want to look at that book about how to make biscuits, whatever. You know, it's the art books. You would never find the children's books. You would never find. And I'm always stopped by something I have no interest in.
Likewise.
Because suddenly, by seeing it, I am interested in it.
That's how I found the book Shantaram, which I never would have found before. And it's also how I decided to read Middlemarch, because I never had any desire to read Middlemarch, just because all of a sudden I saw it there and I go, you know what? I guess I should read that.
I cannot tell you how many copies of Shantaram I own.
Me too. And
I've never read it. I've started it a couple of times. It's kind of just not for me, you know. It's a very specific kind of book. that people in my life are always saying, you've got to read Shantaram. And the other one, I bet I have five copies because people just keep sending it to me, Birdsong.
Oh, yeah. I've never read it. No, I keep meaning to.
Again, I read 50 pages. I thought, this just isn't for me. But those are the two books that people just randomly send me.
People trash, well, some people love Shantaram and its sequel. That's the other thing. When I started to open the bookstore, probably like you, I went around and asked other bookstores, hey, what do I need to do, blah, blah, blah. And they said, you cannot be a bookseller and a book collector at the same time.
Oh,
and
that's a good piece of advice.
And I totally disregarded them, totally. And go to book auctions and buy a first edition signed Shantaram or a first edition first printing of Ulysses signed by, why am I doing this?
But it's nice, though. I was in Bookhampton last week, and they had a shelf in the back, a little glass case of signed first editions. They had a signed first edition of Charlotte's Web, $8,500. I stood there in front of that book for a long time and just thought about it. You know, it's fun.
Yeah. Well, you would have gotten 20% off at least. Plus you're Ann Patchett in the third person.
You know, I really believe that Ann Patchett should pay full price for her books.
Well,
I can't imagine. I wasn't there.
Yeah, you should pay. That's right.
Anybody should pay $8,500 for the copy of Charlotte's Web, it would be me.
Yeah, it's like J.K. Rowling. Not that you're all the way there yet, but you probably...
No, I'm not.
Yeah, it's funny because... talking about the third person, I'm Sam, my daughter Samantha, which I've always called her Samantha, but everyone calls her Sam, so they'll call me up and they'll say, how's Sam doing? And I go, I'm fine, but why are you talking about me in the third person?
There you go. You know, it's funny, my husband is a doctor, and he'll come home and he'll say, oh, yeah, I had a patient come in today who was a real Ann Patchett fan, a real Ann Patchett person. You know, this woman said she'd read all of Ann Patchett's books, and that's how we talk about her.
Yeah, it's like my company or my brother and my company called the Hankin Group. So we have our softball team, and it's called Hankin. And they talk about Hankin, and I'm thinking, oh, well, that's interesting. I wonder how Hankin's doing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Which is, it's kind of nice in a way to be able to separate yourself from yourself.
I'll tell you, the thing that really made the difference for me is I changed my name. You know, I took my husband's name. So I am on my passport, driver's license, credit cards, everything. I'm Ann Van Devender. If I make a reservation, I'm Ann Van Devender. And so I really have very separate personas.
Have you been on an airplane where you're sitting next to someone who's reading your book?
No, I've been on an airplane when I've walked by somebody who's reading my book, but I've not sat down next to them.
If you went to the beach at, say, Stone Harbor, New Jersey, you would see tons of people reading your books. And they're still mostly bel canto.
Yeah, I was on the subway once, and there was a girl, and it wasn't that long ago, but there was a girl reading Patron Saint of Liars, which was my first book. And... she was sitting and I was standing up holding the pole. I mean, it was right next to her. And I waited until my stop. And then I leaned over and I said, I wrote that book when I was 25. And then I got off the train. She just looked up at me like I was a crazy person. And then I just left.
Oh, yeah. That reminds me of the scene on the train with Danny and how all the old women decide he has to be their porter.
Right.
Which almost loses him Celeste. And but she saves him herself too, so so it's funny because, you know, in the book so many things again resonate with me. It's funny how you talk about how Maeve and Danny go down to the free library for readings and signings, and I realize they could go down now and see you.
Yeah, of course, that was not lost on me.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's so nice that you're getting to go to what we called KI because it's right there. People are going to love it because everybody there is going to know exactly what and where you're talking about from 30th Street Station all the way up to next to their house, and they're all going to be looking for the Dutch house.
Right, and that's actually, I asked if I could do an event in Elkins Park. And my publicist was like, no, you're doing something in Philadelphia. You're doing the free library. You need to get going. Go back to New York. And I was like, no, I really, really want to go to that area and do something there. So I'm excited that it worked out.
Yeah, it's a great place because the auditorium is gigantic. Yeah, it'll be great because everyone's going to come for sure. I wish you would come to my bookshop.
Yeah.
So no, I'm going to brag now. We were voted best bookshop on the main line, best bookshop in Philadelphia, Real Simple voted us best bookshop in Pennsylvania, and Atlas Obscura voted us one of the 62 best bookshops in the world.
My God, go you.
I know.
Fantastic.
Not that it's really done anything monetarily for me, but...
Well, no, but still, the honor and the glory are yours.
Yes, I put it at the bottom of our letterhead. So anyway... last question. So, but I think I already know the answer. So when you write a book, and this is not your firstborn, but if it was your firstborn, do you have this sense of loss when you give it away?
Like, no.
Every author answers this differently.
Like a turtle laying my eggs in the sand and crawling away, I never think about those eggs again.
What a great simile.
I kick a little sand on them, say good luck, and crawl off.
As long as someone
I mean, by the time I finish a book, I am so done with it. I am so ready to leave. I've been in that world for so long. You know, if you were scuba diving, there's just this point at which you want to come up again. You want to breathe real air.
Yeah, it's like these interviews. I love doing them. It's like the 400th one I've done. But I would never listen to them.
Exactly. Exactly. And I wouldn't either. I don't read interviews. I don't listen to them. I don't read the books again. You know, you live in that world, and it's beautiful. It's just the greatest thing in the world. But then you go on, and there's another world. That's what makes it all interesting.
And the one thing neither of us take for granted is... the fact that people come into our bookstores, bookshops, and they love being there. And they just have this feeling that they belong there. We have a coffee shop, too. So it's just this idea of them coming in. And even when they give me compliments now, it's not the compliment. I'm just happy that they're happy. And then I think, well, money, 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 like you were talking about, it really doesn't make any difference. But if you're making people happy every day, what more could you possibly do with your life?
It's so true. It's so true. Well, I'm glad you're doing it. I'm glad you have a job that you love.
Likewise, I'm glad that you do too. Do you have that same feeling?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a wonderful thing.
Okay, so luckily you'll be with us soon. Tomorrow. You'll be at the Free Library at Turf That You Know at 7 p.m., Everybody knows where the Free Library is downtown around Logan Circle. And then the next day, you'll be at a wonderful place in Elkins Park, which is Knesset Israel, the Reformed Temple. And it's a locale that's basically surrounded by every location in the book. And I know so many people will like that. Oh, and that, by the way, that's 9:30, not 9:30 at night, 9:30 in the morning. So We've been talking to Anne about her latest book, The Dutch House. It's a wonderful book. I can't recommend it as highly. It's all about me, basically, by the way. So thanks so much, Anne, and thanks so much for taking so much time. I know you have lots and lots of things to do.
It was a complete pleasure, Sam, and I enjoyed talking to you so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We were talking with Anne Padgett about her latest work, which is The Dutch House. And, you know, she's written so many great things. The Magician's Assistant, State of Wonder, other books, but Bel Canto, which won so many awards and was made into a movie, I believe. And just is a fascinating book. Maybe you should start with that one. But you can easily, I mean, The Dutch House is also a great place to start. And it's a different kind of book. And if you look at the cover, as she was talking about, it intrigues you. and gives you an idea that something inside is going to be different, perhaps, than something else you've ever read. And it is. And she has a wonderful bookstore called Parnassus, and she has a bookmobile, which I've always wanted to have at Wellington Square Bookshop. And then, you know, hang out in Coatesville and Parksburg, where people don't get a chance to read books and give the books away, which would be wonderful. And maybe someday I'll do it. So, if I can ever make any money. I'll plug, since she has her Parnassus, I'll plug Wellington Square Bookshop, which is in the town center in Eagle View, which has lots of wonderful, wonderful shops and restaurants. In fact, we call it Restaurant Row. There's Brickside Restaurant. There's Al Pastor, which is Mexican. There's Suburban, which is farm to table. There's Bright Spot, which is a great place for breakfast or lunch. There's even Arita's there, and soon to be more. So, anyway, I hope you'll join us every week. Now it's been 7 or 8 years. Some of you have. Either whether you're listening to this on WCHE or streaming it on WCHE or listening to it on Podomatic or listening to it on iTunes. Thank you. So anyway, next guest we have coming up, New York Times bestselling author J. Ryan Stradell, to discuss his latest novel, The Lager Queen of Minnesota, which is getting all kinds of press. In fact, The Week magazine, which I get it every week, has an article about it this week. Amy Waldman will join us to discuss her highly anticipated novel, which is A Door in the Earth, which I'm really looking forward to. And then the National Book Award winner and Pulitzer Prize finalist, Tim O'Brien, is going to discuss his memoir, which is also fascinating. It's called Dad's Maybe Book. So for a complete schedule, as always, you can visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com, WCHE1520.com, or simply download our podcast at Podomatic, which is really good there. I mean, you get to listen, speed it up, slow it down. I would speed it up because you can listen to half of me. It goes so fast that you don't have to spend an entire 48 or 54 minutes with me. You can have it. I wouldn't go more than double because then you can't understand. So you can, and then you can also do the same thing on iTunes if you would like. So once again, thanks as always, and we hope to have you back here for another what I consider a great show, but that's because I'm doing it, on the Avid Reader.